Welcome to the debrief, everybody. Developments in two cases, one today, one from yesterday, are drawing attention to what happens to prisoners behind bars in America. Let's begin with the case of Wisconsinite Jake Patterson, who admitted to kidnapping Jamie Kloss, a teenager, after murdering her parents. He's serving two life sentences, plus additional time at a prison in New Mexico. Authorities moved him there for safety after they say he was disruptive at a Wisconsin prison. Well, Patterson is back in the news again after the Green Bay, Wisconsin Press Gazette uncovered documents which say he was approached by two inmates who inquired about his case. Apparently, other inmates told him they didn't want him living in their pod. Then things escalated. Patterson is said to have thrown a punch and then lied to prison officials about why he was behind bars in the first place. He told them he was there because he had met an older teen online and helped her run away from home. Patterson is really there because he admitted kidnapping Jamie Kloss after barging into her house. He killed one of her parents at the door, then killed the other inside. Kloss escaped after 88 days in captivity and ran to neighbors for help. Here's the letter she wrote to the court after Patterson pleaded guilty and was being sentenced.
I don't want to even see my home or my stuff because of the memory of that night. My parents and my home were the most important things in my life. He took them away from me in a way that will always leave me with a horrifying memory. I have to have an alarm in the house now just so I can sleep. I used to love to go out with my friends. I loved to go to school. I loved to do dance. He took all of those things away from me too. It's too hard for me to go out in public. I get scared and I get anxious. These are just ordinary things that anyone like me should be able to do, but I can't because he took them away from me. But there are some things that Jake Patterson can never take from me. He can't take my freedom. He thought that he could own me, but he was wrong. I was smarter. I watched his routine and I took back my freedom. I will always have my freedom and he will not. Jake Patterson can never take away my courage. He thought he could control me, but he couldn't. I feel like what he did is what a coward would do. I was brave, and he was not. He can never take away my spirit. He thought that he could make me like him, but he was wrong. He can't ever change me or take away who I am. He can't stop me from being happy and moving forward with my life. I will go on to do great things in my life, and he will not. He should stay locked up forever.
Kloss has since said that she's doing a lot better. The defendant himself briefly spoke in court before he was officially sentenced.
I'll just say that I would do, like, absolutely anything to take back what I did, you know. I would die. I would do absolutely anything to bring them back, you know. I don't care about me, I'm just so sorry. That's all.
Okay, so he's fighting behind bars. The other case raising questions about what's going on behind bars in Americans' prisons this week is the explosive opinion that millionaire pedophile Jeffrey Epstein may have been killed in prison by someone else. Officials say Epstein committed suicide in a federal jail in New York while awaiting prosecution on sex crimes charges. But cameras there weren't working, and guards say that they were sleeping rather than making their rounds. Epstein's official cause of death was suicide by hanging, but forensic pathologist Dr. Michael Bodden said he believed otherwise. He said three fractures suggest Epstein was killed.
Was it more consistent with the homicide, Jeffrey Epstein's death?
More consistent, as from the information we now have, as a homicide.
And indeed, one of the things you're showing us and has never been seen before is a diagram and a picture from the autopsy report, which we have actually here on the screen. The red arrows were added by me, by the way. Now, that was not the original. but it shows the fractures, the three fractures you discussed, one in the hyoid bone and two in the thyroid cartilage, if I get that right.
Right.
And there you can see them. Look at them on the, and that's actually Jeffrey Epstein's hyoid bone on the right side of your screen, and the diagram of where the three fractures were on the left side of your screen.
Dr. Bodden is, of course, the husband of criminal defense attorney and Law and Crime host Linda Kenny Bodden, who you saw there and who appears frequently on this broadcast. With me tonight, though, are attorneys Catherine Smith and Brian Buckmeyer. So, Catherine, what's going on inside the prisons? You've got Patterson getting in fights. Apparently, they move him all the way from Wisconsin down to New Mexico for safety. Well, they figure out who he is down there. It allegedly results in punches being thrown. Where do they put him?
Exactly. You know, it's really hard to balance the safety in the institutions with being able to keep order overall. When you have a high-profile criminal like that, you have to put a lot of resources and a lot of time into making sure that person doesn't get hurt, a la Epstein, right? But you need to be able to do that because these prisoners don't have any other recourse. They're relying on the guards in the institution to make sure they keep them safe. So there needs to be better solutions.
So they've got them in seclusion now, Brian Buckmeyer. Is that the proper remedy here, or do they throw the dart at the map and pick another state to move Patterson?
I think seclusion has its own problem. I think Katie actually touched on this earlier today perfectly, that seclusion in of itself is a type of punishment that can really hurt the mental status of a person. But putting them in a facility where there are people who are less likely to harm him, either people with similar charges or elderly or sick, might be a better recourse for this type of situation.
Let's talk about the Epstein matter now. So we've got one opinion that this was homicide from Dr. Bodden. He's working with the family of Jeffrey Epstein. You've got the official opinion that no, this was suicide by hanging. Is it a conspiracy theory? Who's right and who's wrong here?
You know, it always comes down to the battle of the experts. And I know when I looked on lawandcrime.com, I saw that there was also someone else who had weighed in and said that this triple type of fracture, because of the sturdiness of the jawbone and the mandible, is unlikely to cause this type of triple fracture. So I think that there's some evidence there.
Brian Buckmeyer, your thoughts. Epstein, suicide, murder, what was it?
I mean, my mindset has always been that this is the perfect storm of no cameras, no surveillance, and then now we get this. I mean, I think this might be either confirming my bias that this was always a murder to begin with, or maybe, I don't know, it's just a perfect storm and it was a suicide.
You know, even if it was a suicide, the other circumstances are what is injecting doubt into the minds of too many people. And as you said, it's a perfect storm. I'm more likely to believe that it was a suicide, but boy, I wish I knew for certain. And that's what's bugging me about it. We're going to move on now. Several criminal cases on dockets today dealing with sports figures. Penn State University investigating new sexual assault allegations against former assistant football coach Jerry Sandusky. Sandusky is accused of abusing a new victim at the university between the year 2000 and 2010. Sandusky previously was sentenced to up to 60 years in prison for dozens of sexual assaults that occurred when he was a defensive coordinator at Penn State. Earlier this year, an appeals court ruled the use of mandatory minimums in the case was improper. Sandusky scheduled to be resentenced next week. One of the suspects charged in the killing of NBA basketball player Lorenzen Wright made a brief appearance in court today. Billy Turner is accused of killing Wright back in 2010. The former Memphis Grizzlies star was found shot to death at a golf course. Turner was arrested in 2017 alongside Wright's ex-wife, Shara Wright. She pleaded guilty to facilitating first-degree murder earlier this year. The judge today ordered Turner to return to court in December. If he can't reach a plea agreement with prosecutors by then, a trial date will be set in the case at that next appearance. A criminal investigation now open in the disappearance of the stepdaughter of a UFC heavyweight. Alabama prosecutors say they don't believe 19-year-old college student Anaya Blanchard went missing on her own accord. UFC president Dana White made this announcement to try to help find that missing person.
Blanchard is the 19-year-old daughter of one of the members of the UFC family, Walt Harris, and she's gone missing. Anaya was last seen in Auburn, Alabama on October 23rd. To help find Anaya, I'm contributing an additional $25,000 to Alabama Governor Kay Ivey's $5,000 reward for information leading to the arrest and conviction of the perpetrators involved in the disappearance of Anaya Blanchard. If you have any information on Anaya's whereabouts, please call Star HP or 911 immediately.
That's the plea for help. A recording made public by the prosecutor who oversaw the cases made famous in the Netflix film Making a Murderer is raising new legal questions about whether authorities can record meetings between attorneys and clients behind bars. Freelance photographer Teresa Halbach disappeared on Halloween Day exactly 14 years ago today. Prosecutor Ken Kratz tried and convicted Stephen Avery and his nephew Brendan Dassey of intentional homicide, but issues involving conflicts of interest plagued the case to this day. Avery maintained he was being set up. Controversy ignited this week when Kratz, the prosecutor, posted this video online to complain that one of Avery's trial attorneys was recording Avery for the Netflix documentary while the two were awaiting a verdict. Kratz argued that it showed the defense and the filmmakers had colluded, but Avery's supporters exploded because the recording, which until now had been secret, basically proves the prosecutor was recording a meeting between an attorney and a client. It's unclear from the recording whether sound was captured. Attorneys' trial attorneys had long questioned whether they were being secretly recorded, but authorities claimed no recordings were being made, and investigations into the matter turned up nothing. Until now, we have the video. Buting tweeted this. This is the first I have seen of surveillance video during attorney-client jail meeting with Stephen Avery. This was confidential meeting room reserved for attorneys. No camera was visible and no notice that we were being recorded. He then thanked the prosecutor, the former prosecutor, for actually making Avery's appeal easier. Kratz responded to suggest that the recording was some sort of a sting operation almost. When being confronted with violating jail policy, videotaping your client in the jail when your filmmaker partners were not allowed, sheriff's reports written, judge talked to you, sheriff wrote reprimand, Buting pretends he didn't remember this incident. Let's jump in with some analysis. Brian Buckmeyer, Catherine Smith, your opinion here on exactly what is going on in this case. Do we have a constitutional rights violation here?
We do, and I'm almost laughing because it's so ridiculous that he released this video knowing that this stuff had been recorded. I do know that there are some rules where you're allowed to visually record, but you're not allowed to record the audio, but there still should be notice to the parties that that's going on.
Brian Buckmeyer, here's what bothers me about this. I'm unsettled that the law seems to be so unsettled in this area because everybody blew up on Twitter this week and basically said, hey, look, this shouldn't be allowed. And the purists who look at the Sixth Amendment would turn around and say, yeah, it shouldn't be allowed. I was digging into some of the case law, and there's a U.S. Supreme Court case back in 1977 that says, when conversations with counsel have been overheard, the constitutionality of the conviction depends on whether the overheard conversations have produced directly or indirectly any of the evidence offered at trial. It's almost like an exclusionary rule. So in other words, this suggests that maybe they can do it. They just can't use what they get out of it. It just still feels fundamentally unfair.
It feels fundamentally unfair because it is fundamentally unfair. And even as a lawyer, you can pick apart those words because you said overheard. So I can say, hey, I didn't hear anything. I just saw the visuals. Maybe I can read lips instead of hearing. And then you say, well, I can only use the information against you. It's kind of like your Miranda warnings where it's like, hey, I don't need to give you Miranda. I just can't use these statements against you. But still, you can't parse that from your prosecution and you shouldn't be allowed to. That's why it should not be in at all.
Yeah, I mean, this just makes me feel funny that the law is so unsettled. You hit on that. We've got some other issues. This isn't isolated to this case. We've got the litigation in federal courts over the recordings in the Leavenworth prison in Kansas. There was a big issue in Los Angeles a couple of years about this. I mean, are your conversations in jail, Catherine, being recorded? Are you afraid of that? Brian is.
Yes,
and you're
100%.
Saying yes.
I just had a conversation with one of my clients who was in jail, and he was said he was on, you know, he's afraid to talk. And I was like, listen, they're not supposed to record our conversations, but they probably do. And that's the general wisdom.
And Brian, you're jumping
in. I've had prosecutors tell me your clients love you. They say great things about you. They've quoted things that I've said to my client. I'd be like, wait, how do you know that I've said that? And they're like, oh, no, like we just they're listening all the time. That's why I go to Rikers and I talk to my clients in person, because it is garbage that they're not listening to us.
So you're talking about phone calls. We've got that issue. I mean,
yeah.
Those are getting recorded in places. Then we've got this hidden camera allegedly in the Avery room. And this is going back, what, more than 10 years. So I'm left running out of things to say about it. We can all complain about it. I would like to see more clarity in the law on this. And still ahead tonight here on The Debrief, yet another restriction against the press in the case of a Colorado man accused of murdering his fiancée. And we are patiently waiting to bring you the retrial of former NFL player Kellen Winslow II. Jury selection drags on days longer than expected as prosecutors suddenly drop two of the eight outstanding charges. We have been waiting all week for testimony to commence in several trials. One involves murder charges filed in Colorado against Patrick Frazee. He's accused of beating his fiancée, Kelsey Barrett, to death with a baseball bat. Authorities say Crystal Lee Kenny cleaned up the aftermath at Frazee's request. Barrett disappeared after this surveillance footage released by authorities showed her out grocery shopping with her baby around Thanksgiving last year. We cannot broadcast the trial or tweet from court under the judge's orders. The judge is even banning a sketch artist from the courtroom. Back during the investigation into Barrett's disappearance, police noticed unusual activity on Barrett's phone. That's what helped tie the case together.
Kelsey's been missing and been reported missing by her mother, Cheryl, since Sunday, December 2nd. At about 12:37 p.m. Mountain Standard Time. Officers were able to contact her place of employment at Doss Aviation down in Pueblo, Colorado, and were advised that they had received a text from Kelsey's phone on the 25th of November stating that she would not be into work the following week. Officers from the Woodland Park Police Department did respond to Kelsey's residence on December 2nd and performed the community caretaker search of her residence to see if they could locate her. She was not inside her residence. Cheryl did reach out to Kelsey's fiance, Patrick Frazee, and he called her back saying that he hadn't heard from her since November 25th when Kelsey texted him. Patrick told officers that he hadn't seen her since Thanksgiving, November 22nd, when he exchanged their daughter, Kelsey, correction, Kaylee Barrett. Kaylee is currently with her father, Patrick.
4 days later, police had a different tone when speaking about Frazee.
Investigators obtained a search warrant today, correction, yesterday, on a property nearby in Teller County, Colorado. That search is currently being conducted. This property is where Patrick Frazee is known to reside. Assisting the Woodland Park Police Department in this search is the Teller County Sheriff's Office, the Teller County Search and Rescue, the District Attorney's Office, the Colorado Bureau of Investigation, and the Federal Bureau of Investigation. There are no details available about the search as this warrant has been sealed. This is a multi-state task force with numerous resources working tirelessly to find Kelsey, which is why I'm here today. We are asking Patrick to sit down with investigators since he is the last person to talk with Kelsey face-to-face based on our investigation. There have been numerous questions about whether Patrick is a suspect or a person of interest. At this point, we are considering every possibility, and I'm not willing to jump to conclusions or label people involved in this highly complex investigation.
And we're waiting for the trial to start in that case. We are also waiting, again, as patiently as possible for the retrial of Kellen Winslow II. Five women came forward against a former NFL player and accused him of a series of sex crimes. A jury convicted Winslow last summer on three counts and acquitted on one. The jury, however, was deadlocked on eight other counts. Prosecutors are retrying Winslow on six of the eight. Prosecutors decided not to move forward with cruelty and battery against an elder. Both of those counts resulted from the testimony of the so-called Jane Doe number 5, a 77-year-old woman who accused Winslow of lewd conduct at a health club. The original jury convicted on one core charge related to her accusations, but acquitted as to another. And finally tonight, a legal controversy surrounding a sheriff and sex offenders. This time, it's the sheriff who's on the other side of the law. My colleague Jesse Weber here at Law and Crime takes it from here with guest attorney Terry Austin.
So it's Halloween, it's a fun time, but sometimes it's kind of scary about where your kids might be going tonight, right? How would you feel if you knew which houses in the block were potentially dangerous? For example, would you want to know which houses were those of sex offenders? Well, last year, a Georgia sheriff placed signs outside the homes of registered sex offenders warning the community to not trick-or-treat at these houses. Now, before this could happen again this year, the sex offenders filed a lawsuit claiming that their rights were violated, and a federal judge just granted an injunction preventing the sheriff from posting these warning signs. Terry, what exactly, what rights do they say were violated, and what did the judge believe? Because the judge believed something that about the sex offenders case.
Right. The judge believed here that they went too far in posting the signs, that even though the sheriff was trying to do the right thing for the community, he did the wrong thing as far as these sex offenders are concerned. They have a right to not have someone trespass on their property and post this sign, and they have a right not to have this forced speech, basically saying that I am a sex offender. They can register, obviously. In fact, they have to register, and there's a penalty if they don't register. But they don't have to put a sign saying, I'm a sex offender. The sheriff could have done it another way. He could have made sure, he could have handed out flyers, for instance.
Okay, let's jump in and discuss this with a couple of minutes we have left here. Brian Buckmeyer, so this all hinges on First Amendment grounds, and the property line is the key to understanding it under the judge's ruling. The state can basically force these people to register, and then the information is on the state's site. That's the state's property. But the judge is saying the sheriff can't just go up, basically trespass, and put signs in people's lawns and force them to speak that way.
Yeah, it's not so much a what, but a how issue. Him warning or alerting other people that they're a sex offender, and also not knowing what level they are, because sex offender is a very broad description, and a lower level might not need to report as a higher level would, and the trespass is obviously an issue as well. So again, it's the how more than the what.
Yeah, Catherine, I mean, he could have put a press release out, he could have put something on his website and say, don't go here, these are the addresses, go check the registry in your area. That would have been completely legal.
Exactly. I mean, you have to think, as much as we don't like sex offenders, they also have rights too. And this can become, at a certain point, harassing and violative of their own personal rights to have people trespass on their property and then label them this way. I think it's too far.
Brian Buckmeyer, are you in agreement? Too far on this?
Too far. The mechanism in which he did this was too far. There are other ways and other ways that he could have made children and the community safe. This is just like some vigilante going out there and posting on people's walls.
Vigilante sheriff, sort of an interesting concept here at the Law and Crime Network around the table today. My next question that I don't know the answer to is what the remedy is. Okay, so if there's a violation of First Amendment rights here, is the remedy some kind of monetary payment? I'm curious about that.
Well, and also, I think the violation, as I'm looking at it, could be criminal in the sense that it was trespass. So, I mean, what do you do?
Well, we get to see if the sheriff gets arrested, apparently. That's all the time we have here on The Debrief. Appreciate the insight from Brian and Catherine. We'll see you here tomorrow at 5 o'clock. Take care.